From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The Flint, Michigan drinking water crisis 3 years ago turned the nation's attention on public drinking water and whether it's safe. Also, several New Hampshire communities have had their own concerns about groundwater contamination. And so, perhaps in part because of these worries, more Americans these days are seeking what's called raw water, unfiltered, untreated water from local springs. These water foragers, as they call themselves, say they trust this water more than tap water, with all the added chemicals or the long trip through aging pipes. But is this raw water really any better or safer? Would it even be dangerous? That's what NHPR's Outside In team explored in a recent episode called Magical Drinking. And today in The Exchange, we pick up on that story. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests with us in studio. Taylor Quimby is here, senior producer for NHPR's creative production unit, which includes Outside In. He worked on the episode we're going to talk about. Taylor, thank you for helping us out.
Oh, thank you.
Also with us, Paul Suska, supervisor for the planning unit at the Drinking Water and Groundwater Bureau for the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Paul, good to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Happy to be here.
Also with us, Joe Ayotte, chief of the Groundwater Quality Section for the New England Water Science Center and a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. And Joe, welcome back. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, Taylor, in your episode, you cite some pretty sweeping health claims that people make about raw water or natural spring water, call it whatever you want. And you say that there's always been this aura of mystery around spring water. What's that aura all about, Taylor?
Well, I think there's something of an aura of mystery around springs because where does the water come from? You know, it's you're looking at a piece of earth, and then the water just often pops out of this pipe. It never turns off. It just goes and goes and goes. And there is something sort of wild about that when you're used to turning your tap on and off and thinking about where your tap water comes from. In terms of the claims that I've heard sort of reporting on this story, there's a lot of interesting directions that it goes in. And so, you know, we heard from folks, Tourmaline Springs in Maine, they're a company that bottles untreated spring water. They call it on their bottle sacred living water. Live Water is another company. Their slogan is perfected by nature. We heard some anecdotes from multiple people who said that drinking spring water makes you feel twice as hydrated as drinking other waters, which is sort of a difficult thing to measure. You know, so a lot of anecdotal stories about why people felt better drinking spring water. Those claims, I think, fell into a couple different areas, which is interesting. Some folks saying spring water is especially pure, so there's almost no stuff in it. There's other folks who are saying, well, spring water has minerals and things that are good for you, so they're actually talking about impurities that they're saying are good for you. And then there was a lot of folks in this sort of raw water area who are also casting some skepticism over the chemicals and processes that we use to treat tap water. So a little contradictory at times about what is actually the claim on spring water.
And you guys obviously talked about, you know, New England and New Hampshire, but you also looked at this really big trend out in Northern California, mm-hmm. sort of Silicon Valley, San Francisco Bay Area. I mean, there the claims are sort of, you know, you can leap buildings in a single bound if you drink this.
Well, and also just some, like, just really wild stuff. So Live Water, the guy who owns and operates that, at some point during an interview in the New York Times, he says that, you know, water only stays fresh for one lunar cycle because that water will turn green eventually, and says that's a good thing. I think most folks think green water is probably not.
Yeah. Well, after this New York Times article came out revealing this raw water trend, craze kind of in California, people making all sorts of health claims, charging hefty prices. So there's always a dollar to be made for some of this. This came out. Then there was all this pushback. Comedians like Stephen Colbert had a field day with this topic. Let's just hear a little bit from that.
Raw water is flying off the shelves in San Francisco, with one store selling 2.5 gallons of raw water for $60.99. Fun fact, that's the same copay for your doctor's visit after drinking unsterilized water. Some raw water companies even collect untreated water from the atmosphere. One investor told the New York Times that this water is special and added, Now, is that because I saw it come off the roof and anything from the roof feels special? Maybe. Is that completely stupid? Definitely.
Again, that's comedian Stephen Colbert talking about the raw water trend, which is taking off around the country, especially, as he put it, out in the San Francisco area. Paul Suska, I want to ask you, too, how do you feel about the rising numbers of people seeking spring water bypassing the tap?
Well, it's certainly easy to understand why folks have some distrust for water that's served up by public water systems, given, as you mentioned, the Flint water crisis, which was definitely a failure of the state to make sure that the water was safe. And there have been other contaminants showing up in our groundwater in New Hampshire. Years ago, MTBE, the gasoline additive, was showing up everywhere. More recently, there have been some compounds, perfluorinated compounds in particular, showing up in the Merrimack area, the seacoast. So it's easy to understand why folks feel that something that's natural might be safer for them. And as Taylor mentioned, people feel better about spring water. And they also seem to feel better, ironically, about natural contaminants in water than they do about anything that's industrial. So they're willing to accept greater risk from natural contaminants than they are willing to accept a risk from any man-made contaminant.
What is a natural contaminant?
Well, the naturally occurring contaminants fall into two groups. There are the minerals like radon and arsenic that come from the bedrock, and then there's the microbiological or the germs, the bacteria and the viruses.
Well, and as part of the Outside In episode, Taylor and the team talked to Frank Chappelle. He's a U.S. Geological Survey scientist featured in the episode. He said that there are different parts of these natural contaminants in New Hampshire drinking water because of the bedrock, because of just who we are and what our granite state is made up of. Let's hear a little bit from Frank Chappelle talking about that.
If I had a well and I lived in New Hampshire, I would get a radon test because, you know, that's something that has been associated with a variety of cancers. Another thing that I would do if I was in New Hampshire, is the other thing I'd do is I'd do an arsenic test.
So again, that's Frank Chappelle talking about the naturally occurring stuff in our water here in New Hampshire, just because of our state's makeup. And Joe, I'd love to hear from you, too, your thoughts on what we heard from Frank Chappelle, but also this broader idea of, you know, more people saying, look at Flint, look at Merrimack, look at the seacoast. We're not trusting our public water.
That's right. It's interesting. I grew up in Exeter, where the jailhouse spring is located, and we made weekly visits to that spring, filling gallons of water in jugs, taking it home and drinking it. And, you know, as a child, I had no idea what was in that water, good or bad. And I don't believe my parents did either. But we should. You know, maybe that water was better than the tap water. Maybe it wasn't. And the only way to really know is to get a test done to really understand what's in that water. Toward Frank's point about radon and arsenic, those are probably the two biggest contaminants that are geologically derived in the state. You could argue that arsenic is probably the biggest health risk some people have. But radon, for example, is high almost everywhere in New Hampshire. Testing only tells you how much higher you are than the very high values that we normally see.
And radon is, again, naturally occurring because of the granite in the granite state, but it's cancer-causing a lot. And arsenic, we know it as a poison, right?
Right. Arsenic is definitely a poison. There's no human benefit to ingesting it, quite the opposite. And we know now roughly where it occurs in the state and with what frequency. And we also know how it varies over time it's definitely prudent to have your water tested and then to take some action if you have it.
So how do you feel, Joe, about this trend that Taylor covered of more and more people seeking out so-called raw water?
Well, it is interesting, and it's a fascinating thing to think about and discuss.
But given that you drank it yourself as a kid from one of the springs that Taylor
given
visited.
Given that, and yeah, indeed. But as a scientist, and knowing what I know now, really the only thing that people should be thinking about is trying to understand the chemical composition of their water, whether that's through a test of their own private well or a spring, or by reading the reports that come out from public water suppliers, which are very helpful.
Very helpful, but as you found, Taylor, sometimes concerning for folks. Go ahead.
Yeah. Are you talking about Exeter?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we visited several springs in the episode, including Jailhouse Spring in Exeter, with Joe, actually. And we talked to a few folks who were filling up there, because often at these places, there's a line of cars, people coming in and out and filling up. And we spoke with one woman who you know, pointed out one of the reasons she's been drinking this water for years is that she sees these quarterly reports from the town of Exeter, their public water department, and understands that there are contaminants in there that are carcinogenic. She can't really remember the names of them, but she says, hey, I get these every quarter. It's really concerning. And so I'd rather drink from the spring because it comes from the ground. It must be pure.
And look at all these other people who are here.
Exactly. Yeah, there's sort of an inertia to the number of people that are visiting a spring and drinking from it if they're not necessarily falling down sick. And, you know, if you look into that, there is some issues with Exeter's water. They've got trihalomethanes, which is a byproduct of chlorination. And they have been over the legal limit for years now, and they're working on getting it down and working on getting it down. I think the issue that you point at, Joe, and generally here, is that if you know that something, you know, if you know one source of water has an issue, to turn to another source of water that you know nothing about is not necessarily the answer. As a scientist, if you have two sources of water and you only have data about one of them, you cannot recommend the other that you know nothing about. And if you had as much data as you have of the public water of various springs, you might actually be able to make different judgments, but we don't have the testing.
Well, and those multisyllabic chemicals that you mentioned in those quarterly reports are concerning. They sound terrifying.
Yeah, I think that Joe and Paul here would probably know exactly what they're looking at. But when I sort of started digging in, I don't have the background. And I have to admit, you know, it is very overwhelming when you sort of, let's see, I've got actually one of Exeter's piece here, and you're looking at asbestos, arsenic, fluoride, dichloroethylene, halo something, acids, you know, stuff that I don't know anything about.
Forget it. I'll just run to the spring. It looks
right.
Better.
So all the information is actually there, but to your, you know, average water consumer, it's hard to know what you're looking at sometimes.
Okay, and I know you guys want to jump in as well. I definitely want to invite our listeners to join us. Your comments, questions, concerns about the rising interest in raw water. As I said, a recent episode of NHPR's Outside In examines this. Visiting some of the springs in New Hampshire that people use to get their water, talking to people there, and digging into the truth, the data, and definitely some of the mythology behind this raw water trend. We'd love to hear from you. Do you get your water from a local spring? What does it taste like? What do you like about it? What do you make of concerns that it's not tested or treated? And overall, what does the growing interest in springs say about confidence in our public water supplies? Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Paul, I did want to ask you, too, about, you know, you get these quarterly reports from your local municipal water supply. If you're on public water, we should talk about people in New Hampshire who are on wells in a moment. How do people react to those reports? Taylor's right. There's lots of creepy-sounding chemicals on them.
Right. Well, there's a lot of information in those reports, and they include not just a list of the chemicals and the other contaminants that have been detected, but some explanation of what they are and what the risks are that are associated with them. Unfortunately, there's a lot of contaminants out there, and so there's a lot of information in those reports. And I think it is difficult for people to digest and then to really remember what the concerns are. I think that Taylor mentioned today, and also during the program, the magical drinking program, that these disinfection byproducts, that is, chemicals that result from chlorination, the chlorine reacts with naturally occurring compounds, and so even small amounts of those disinfection byproducts can be potentially harmful. But it's a pretty small risk compared to being over the limit on something like arsenic, or having a short-term risk from something like bacteria. Joe had mentioned it's important to know the chemical composition, but the bacteriological composition, that is, what germs are there or what germs might be there, is also very important. Those are the things that can make you sick right away as opposed to after years of drinking.
Well, and there's lots of social science that shows that, you know, most of us are pretty bad at assessing risk. Mm-hmm. And these things are measured in, you know, parts per billion or trillion. And so you see it. And the measurement is tiny, but you don't know that that's really tiny. You don't know what level is problematic and what isn't.
Right. And it varies tremendously. For some chemicals, parts per trillion, that's the standard. What EPA tries to do, and the standards for drinking water, the regulatory standards, are set by the U.S. EPA and their national standards, and that's what we use in New Hampshire. And they typically aim for a risk level of one extra cancer in a million people exposed. So that's a pretty low level of risk. But then when we talk about natural contaminants such as arsenic, the risk can be as much as one in 300 people exposed. That's a much higher risk.
Do you think the standards are set well, Paul? And Joe, I want to hear from you too, because there has been some criticism that the way these levels are set is outdated. This is from the New York Times. EPA's trigger level, for example, of addressing lead in drinking water, 15 parts per billion, is not based on any health threat. Rather, the New York Times says it reflects a calculation that water in at least 9 out of 10 homes susceptible to lead contamination will fall below that standard. That sounds sort of random.
Well, for a lot of the contaminants, the limit is purely health-based. But for a lot of the contaminants, it isn't, lead being one of them. Some of the contaminants, the regulatory level is set at what's the best we can do or what's the best that the vast majority of water systems across the country can do. The thing is, these standards are set, a single number is chosen, or a single set of treatment standards is chosen, and they apply to all the water systems across the country.
Taylor, you want to jump in?
Yeah. You know, I think it's an interesting point that as water quality gets better, we tend to probably set more stringent regulations about where we think acceptable levels should be. So, for example, the trihalomethanes, which is this byproduct in Exeter that this woman is concerned about, they have been violating that since a new level was set, I think in 2014. So it goes to show you that previous to that, we sort of said, well, we don't think or there's been a decision that this isn't a problem. Once we set more stringent regulations, then tap might suddenly be in violation.
I see. So as the standards get tougher, and most people who care about safe drinking water would say, good, I want my water as safe as possible. But it makes that public water supply, Taylor, look worse because it's a new, tougher standard.
Right. And I mean, if you think, you know, 100 years ago or 200 years ago when there are these, you know, massive pandemics related to water quality, the idea that we would be, you know, sort of fighting over very small amounts of chemicals that people had never heard of then would probably be crazy because at that point people are concerned about, you know, the whole cities you know, really suffering massive casualties.
Well, that's really interesting, and it comes up in the Outside In episode, and I do want to talk about that. After a short break, this history of water safety and how that comes up and how we treat it. So we'll talk about that on the other side of the break. We'll also start taking your calls, so join us, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email that just came in from Matt, who says, I'm an environmental scientist from Bedford. This fad is absurd. Matt says, so many contamination issues in our state, such as PFOA and Merrimack, issues going on at Dartmouth College, originate from groundwater contamination. Matt says, well, guess where spring water comes from? The ground. Drinking spring water may help you get away from plumbing and infrastructure-related contamination like lead, but if your groundwater is contaminated, you're out of luck. Matt, thank you for the email. You can send us your emails to exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, magical drinking. We're following up on an episode of NHPR's Outside In on a rising trend in people getting their drinking water from local springs. You can find this story and subscribe to the podcast at outsideinradio.org. And we'd love your questions now. Do you get your water from a spring? What do you make of concerns that it's not tested or treated? And what does the growing interest in springs say about confidence in our public water supplies? We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Paul Seska, Joe Ayotte, Taylor Quimby, let's go right to our listeners. And Ron's calling from Hollis. Hi, Ron. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Hi. Earlier in the program, you talked about getting water tested. First of all, how do you find a reputable place to get your water tested? And the two things that were mentioned, radon and arsenic, it's clear that those are something you want to avoid, but there are other things. In other words, if you have your water tested and a whole list of things are shown, how do you know which of the ones to worry about and which of the ones to ignore? And I guess it's just a matter of knowing, you know, how to get it tested, where to get it tested properly.
And then what do you do once you find the results, right, Ron? I mean, what do you do about that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you for calling in. You know, it's interesting. Paul, a colleague of mine, stopped by my desk this morning and said, oh, I got my well tested. And thank goodness it looks pretty good. But this has been an issue in New Hampshire. A lot of people get their water from a well, and it's kind of up to them to figure it out.
That's right. Private wells are not regulated, just as these springs that we've been talking about are not regulated, in contrast with public water systems, which are heavily regulated. If you're using a private well, of course, we get about 300 calls a year in our program from people with private wells, and they want to know what to test, how, and then what to do with the results. If someone were to search for NHDES private well testing, they would get a hit for our webpage, which has our recommendations on testing. We have a list of 14 different tests that we recommend that everybody do. They come in packages. There's one or two packages of testing that we recommend. And once folks get the results back from the laboratory, the labs are pretty good in flagging the results that are above a standard or that don't conform to a standard. We also have an online tool called Be Well Informed that we developed just in the last few years, that once folks get their lab test result, they can go to Be Well Informed, they can enter the results, and then they'll get very specific recommendations about what needs to be dealt with and also what are their treatment options if they need treatment.
How hard is it to clean it up, so to speak, or improve it once you get results?
Sure. Well, it varies quite a bit. Some folks don't need any treatment at all. Sometimes you have contaminants, usually so-called aesthetic contaminants like iron and manganese, that there might be a taste issue or you might have staining of your fixtures and you need to treat all the water that you're using in the house. But if it's just something like arsenic, which is really a drinking water concern, you can just treat the water that you're using at the tap, and it'll cost you a lot less that way.
So one of those little filtration systems is useful.
Right. Well, you need to use the right kind.
And you can get advice on that from the website and from the labs. So I hope that answered your question, Ron. And thank you very much for calling. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You know, Joe, we talked earlier about how water is treated, public water supplies are treated. And some of the chemicals that Taylor mentioned that come up on those water reports look a little concerning. I'd like to talk about chlorine in particular. You know, a lot of us have heard chlorine is bad. It sounds like bleach. You would never drink bleach. What's the role of chlorine in making our water supplies safer? And is chlorine in and of itself concerning?
Well, chlorine is both a help and a hindrance. But going back historically, and Frank Chappell discusses this in his book, Wellsprings, chlorine really resulted in people being able to drink water without taking an enormous risk of getting sick from the microbiology. So it did more to help people actually get safe drinking water around the time that it was introduced, turn of the century, than almost anything else. And we can't forget that, because that allowed us to grow as a nation. It allowed us to thrive. And now that that's happened, we're more concerned. You know, as Taylor alluded to, we know more about the byproducts from chlorination, how those can be harmful. So we seek to minimize that risk as well. But it is important to note historically that chlorine played a major role in making our drinking water safe.
That's so interesting to hear you say that. It helped us grow as a nation. You know, when I think about that, I think, okay, maybe the railroads are what made America, America, or maybe it was some other, dynamic economic investment. But cleaning up the water helped America grow. And Taylor, you talk about this in the episode. Just remind us of how bad the water used to be.
I mean, you know, we were talking about groundwater and surface water, and a lot of public water came from various surface waters that were not stored in ways that could prevent these sorts of pandemics. And you would have cholera, typhoid, dysentery. You sort of talked about how far we've come. There are actually still cholera epidemics happening in the world. I think Yemen has been dealing with a cholera epidemic, and those are because of water infrastructure issues. I don't know too much of the history, but I just did this Wikipedia searches, and you're looking at hundreds of thousands of people that were dying during many of these epidemics. Staggering what a big deal it was.
And so the chlorine, Paul, kills what used to kill people. Is that basically, animal excrement? I mean, what was it that was causing these outbreaks? And what is the chlorine killing to allow us to, grow and thrive?
Right. Well, the chlorine is killing the germs, the bacteria and the viruses in the water, which the most problematic germs are ultimately from human feces, okay, whether it's from wastewater or some other means of contamination of the water supplies. And so if you look at typhoid, for example, once chlorination of drinking water supplies was introduced in this country, the typhoid rates fell by, orders of magnitude. So as Joe said, it was a huge step forward in public health. Years later, after using chlorine, it was discovered that at certain concentrations, the chlorine, as I said earlier, would react with some naturally occurring compounds in the water, compounds that come from things like decaying leaves, things that aren't health problems in themselves, but after they react with chlorine, that they can form chemicals that are a long-term health risk.
Do you want to jump in, Joe, on that?
All I would say is that, at the same time, things like chlorine helped us out tremendously. There's also the other naturally occurring compounds in water that, people don't taste, don't smell, arsenic and uranium, radon. You can't detect those like you can detect chlorine. So there is the tendency to believe that the water is safer and better. And you still hear people say, even in New Hampshire, that if it smells good, tastes good, and looks good, it is good. But we know very definitively that's not the case. Because there can be these other contaminants that you can't detect without a test.
Well, and in fact, Taylor, you mentioned this in the episode, that part of this raw water trend is people being unsure about the public water supplies, MTBE, lead, whatever it may be. They see it in the headlines. They get nervous. But Frank Chappell from the U.S. Geological Survey also told you guys that it's partly about individual taste. That plays a role in what kind of water we're seeking, and it varies by culture. Let's hear from Frank Chappell again.
The Europeans very much like mineral waters, high concentrations of dissolved solids, and it tastes this way, it tastes that way. And of course, they think it of a very healthy prospect. In the United States, the bottled waters, which have become popular and remain popular over a long period of time, like Poland Spring, have very, very low concentrations of dissolved solids. And the joke is that Europeans drink water for what it has in it, and Americans drink water for what it doesn't have in it, which is dissolved solids.
Again, that's Frank Chappell from the U.S. Geological Survey, featured in the Outside In episode, Magical Drinking, which was about the rising interest in raw water. If you'd like to listen to that full story or subscribe to the podcast, go to outsideinradio.org and join us now with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Taylor Quimby is with us, senior producer for NHPR's Creative Production Unit, which includes Outside In. He worked on the story we're looking at. Joe Ayotte's here, chief of the Groundwater Quality Section for the New England Water Science Center, along with Paul Seska, supervisor for the Planning Unit at the Drinking Water and Groundwater Bureau for New Hampshire DES, Department of Environmental Services. And gentlemen, lots of people who have questions about this raw water trend, their own water supplies. Let's go back to the phones. Dan's in Colebrook. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, hi. I've always been, I was raised on spring water. You could sit there and watch the the jets come right out of the sand blowing up. And, you know, you could watch it. You go down your well and, you know, you could look at that. But, you know, so I've always – we even get my water because I have a dug well. But I get my water for my dogs, which are special, from my mother's spring because I know what the water is, you know. But I have a separate question.
Okay.
A friend of mine is started into the maple syrup business big time, okay, and he has organic maple syrup. But it, the way he does it is with a reverse osmosis. Okay, so when it comes out, it's very, very pure. There's no minerals in it. There's absolutely hardly any taste. And it actually has a blue color to it. You know what I mean? And I'm wondering, you know, if he should think about, I mean, if everybody wants pure water, that's about as pure as you're going to get. It came out of the ground. It came out of the trees. It was filtered out. So that would be some, like, pure, pure water. And he's like, well, if I do this, I'd have to add something to give it a flavor.
Okay. You know, doesn't taste like maple?
A good idea.
Hey, this is...
I'll take my answer off the phone.
Dan, it's really good to hear from you. Anybody? Joe? Paul? I mean, the idea of reverse osmosis and getting water from your trees.
Yeah. So with my understanding of this is for reverse osmosis for maple sugar operations, you're actually removing the water and getting rid of it. And so all of the ions that the reverse osmosis would remove concentrate effectively and remain as part of the flavor of the syrup. But the... you know, in terms of adding water back or adding chemicals back in to make the water have taste, that's right on. And in fact, to follow up on Frank Chappell's comments that you played, whether a water is highly mineralized and like the Europeans prefer, or whether it's very devoid of minerals like we like he says we prefer in the U.S., that's really a function of the time the water has had to interact with the geology through which the water flows.
Oh, so this is old water versus new water, and you hear that a lot on this topic too. Go ahead.
You do hear that a lot, and it's hopelessly complex because different minerals dissolve at different rates. There's different geology across the entire U.S. In the Northeast, we're humid. Our water doesn't stay in the ground for very long before it discharges to streams or we capture it in wells on the order of years, sometimes days, depending on the situation. And this is true for Poland Spring, where the water that flows to that spring may have only traveled hundreds of yards in the ground before it discharges to the spring, which is not very far. By contrast, in Florida, we may see water traveling from, say, Polk City to Fort Meade, Florida, which is about 30 miles. But in groundwater time, that takes about 8,000 years.
Wow.
So the water has plenty of time to interact with the rocks and minerals that are in the aquifer below.
Okay, can I just say I was in Florida a bunch of years ago and I've never tasted such disgusting water in my life. I had to buy bags of, you know, lemons and oranges to put it in it just to make it palatable. So I don't taste, we called it swamp water, but go ahead, Paul.
Well, I think, and that brings up something that was talked about again in Magical Drinking. I think the new water probably is likely to have less minerals. That long residence time in the rock is going to pick up a lot of minerals. In New Hampshire, we have a lot of contaminants in our, a lot of minerals that we don't want in our water. The new water won't have those minerals, but it's more likely to have the bacteria and the springs that were sampled for the program. All of them came back positive for total coliform.
Which is a form of waste bacteria? What is that?
It's a total coliform. It's a very broad group of bacteria. These samples all came back that they did have total coliform. They did not have fecal coliform, which was the good news part. Good news meaning there was no feces, no bacteria from feces. The bad news, there were bacteria probably from the soil, but that means that there's a pathway. Anything that gets into the soil, whether it's feces or decaying animal carcasses, that those bacteria were not filtered out on their way to the spring.
All right, I've got tons of people sending in emails about their wells, especially. So I want to share a couple of these with you. Here's Pam in Goffstown. I recently found our well water to be very high in radon, arsenic, and uranium. She says, I found the DES website, Be Well Informed, that you mentioned, Paul, extremely helpful, as well as the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Toxic Metal Superfund site. Pam says, it is alarming to me that there are no requirements for testing. We've lived in our home for 35 years, so long-term exposure, including prenatal for both my kids. I am heartsick that I didn't keep my family safe. Pam says, I think this should be a required screening to buy or sell a house. I'm in the process of finding out if there is a way to reverse any damage done to our health. Wow, Pam, thank you for the email. And Paul, so you mentioned earlier, most people in New Hampshire are on public water supplies, Concord, Manchester, Keene. But there are, what, 30 to 40% of New Hampshire residents who are on private wells?
It's even more than that. We think that almost half. Our estimate is 46% of households are actually on private wells.
And you said earlier there's no requirement that people test that water when they buy a house?
That's right. Well, there are a handful of municipalities in the state that require testing, say, for a certificate of occupancy. There have been attempts to legislate to require testing for a new well and for a real estate transfer, but that legislation has never gotten very far.
Is it active now? Or
there's nothing active now in that direction. And there's only two states in the country where they have statewide mandatory testing programs, Rhode Island and New Jersey.
Gosh, you'd think, given the concerns about people's water supply and contaminations, natural like radon or man-made like MTBE, you'd think that people would want to get their wells tested before they bought a house.
Well, it's the live free and die state.
Taylor?
You know, I was just going to point out that I think, you know, as we talk about this quote-unquote raw water trend, it is very interesting to think that, yes, perhaps there is a trend of bottling and selling untreated spring water, and maybe especially at a markup to folks who are sort of into the sort of superfood trends have there's a similar vein of thinking. But to your point, people who actually test water have been using the phrase raw water for a very long time, and it just meant untreated raw water that came in to be tested. And in this case, you've got half the state who, folks who are drinking, quote unquote, raw water, but it's not part of that same trend. We don't think about people drinking from their wells as, drinking this sort of trendy raw water stuff, but it's serious fact in the state.
Yeah, because it's more fun to go out and find something bubbling in the forest and that's neat and you can collect it. A well is just a well and that's boring. And it doesn't seem like wild water foraging, which is what some of the proponents call it.
Exactly.
All right. Lots more to talk about after a break. Lots more emails, questions, and comments from our listeners. So if you're on the line, stay there. We'll be back in a minute. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Betsy Gardella, president of NHPR. For more than 37 years, our listeners have faithfully and generously participated in our fund drives, and our recent March drive was no exception. We believe the highest form of gratitude we can offer is to provide you with the finest news and information in the state. To our many sustainers and members who gave during this drive, thank you. Your support strengthens our service to the people of New Hampshire.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, Current Use, the long-debated program that encourages open space through favorable tax treatment for landowners. Send an email on Current Use on your thoughts or experiences and join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. This hour on The Exchange, magical drinking. We're following up on a recent episode of NHPR's Outside In on the growing popularity of what's called raw water. Do you drink from a spring near your home? Have you had the water tested or treated? And what do you think this says about confidence in our public water supplies? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Paul Suska, supervisor for the planning unit at the Drinking Water and Groundwater Bureau for the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Joe Ayotte, chief of the Groundwater Quality Section for the New England Water Science Center and a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and Taylor Quimby, senior producer for NHPR's creative production unit, which includes Outside In. Again, if you want to hear the full story, subscribe to the podcast, go to outsideinradio.org. So, gentlemen, lots more people with questions, so let's go right back to them. Here's one from Frank, who sent us an email. He says, our Bedford well was dug in 1968, 235 feet deep. It was tested at the time and in the early 70s. It gave us delicious water, better than any we have tasted elsewhere. Frank says, two questions. Any idea where deep well water like ours originated? And he says, we've gotten this kind of question from a lot of people. What kind of dangers can the water in our deep well have developed since it was last tested? So this is for you, Joe, but anybody else jump in. Two great questions from Frank that I'm guessing a lot of listeners have.
So yeah, it's always of interest where the source of these waters originates. And in New England, where we're humid and we have a lot of precipitation, and we have deep bedrock aquifers overlain by material deposited by the glaciers, that is also an aquifer.
An aquifer, Joe?
An aquifer, in really simple terms, is just a reservoir of geologic material that can hold and store and transmit water to a well. It's a source of water to wells and springs. And generally, the water in our aquifers is not particularly old compared to other places around the world or even in this country. I mentioned Florida, you know, many tens of thousands of year old water. We don't see very much of that. Our waters are on the order of hundreds of years in general.
Is that because we're just a wetter environment?
It's a combination of factors, including the wetter environment, but also the geologic makeup of our landscape. So those combine to essentially dictate how water flows and how long it will stay in the ground.
Well, and Taylor, you know, in part of the hype around the raw water, and this is people who are trying to sell it and make, you know, a lot of profit, not, you know, your average person who's by the spring with their jug. There was a lot of sort of playing with words like deep, old, mm-hmm. sort of making it sound, yeah, really cool.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought that this was one of the problematic issues with some of the sort of raw water advocates, which is that some would sort of basically provide guidelines that may be more sensible towards a particular region, but they're not specifying where they are and where they're getting their spring water from. So, for example, one gentleman who created a website called findaspring.com, his name is Daniel Vitalis, and he would talk a lot about TDS, the total dissolved solids, basically the amount of stuff that's sort of in the water. And he would talk about his ideal TDS being, I think, around 60, which in some areas in New England, you know, might make sense, although it really doesn't tell you very much about the water at all.
Well, and what are those solids? You know,
exactly my point.
Are they good solids or bad solids? We don't know.
But either way, if you were out west, that TDS for totally drinkable water could be way up. I think, Joe, you said somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000.
500 to 1,000, sure.
Yeah.
And is TDS kind of a made-up thing by this Daniel Vitalis, or is it a real scientific measurement? It's real, Joe. Okay.
It is. It's kind of an indicator constituent that we measure to give us an idea of just how much stuff might be in the water.
But not passing value judgment on that stuff. Again, it might be good stuff or bad stuff. It might be total, I'm going to say it wrong, chloroforms, or it might be radon, or it might be, you know, who knows?
Minerals.
Right.
Minerals, good minerals, bad minerals, who knows?
It's basically the ions in the water And it can be a lot, and we do see things. We look at it because it tells us things. For example, we know through studies across the U.S. As part of our National Water Quality Assessment Program that the higher that number is for TDS, the more likely it is that you will have an increased number of geologically occurring contaminants. So in general, low TDS is a good indicator. But nevertheless, it still doesn't tell you what's in the water exactly.
Go ahead, Taylor.
And it has so much to do with where you are. You mentioned the geology being a big part of understanding, you know, where a spring is actually coming from and whether or not it's this old or young water. It seems to me that almost, after talking to you, almost every measurement is a little squishy because, you know, it's underground. It's hard to know. And so, you know, we look at some of these tests that we do, and often they're an indication that there should be more testing. So, for example, the total coliform, if you have a hit for total coliform, well, that means maybe you need to make sure you're also doing a fecal coliform and then an E. coli test. And so there's this sort of ramp up of, here's something we can figure out. Now we need to do more and know more before we can really say much about the water at all.
And then, picking up on what Taylor said, then there's more testing, more data, and then people get overwhelmed, like the woman in your story, Taylor, who was like, oh, look at all these chemicals in my public water. I can't deal with it. I'm just going to go to the spring. Paul?
Well, right. As Taylor said, positive test results such as total coliform, we wouldn't let a public water system get away with that. They would have to do a lot of work to find out where the bacteria are coming from, and then they'd have to fix that. We wouldn't just let them get away with it. So it just speaks to the fact that, again, public water system is heavily tested and regulated. Private wells are not. I believe it was the caller one comment for Frank, who was talking about the taste of his water, and I just want Frank to know that it's not the taste that matters, it's the test.
In other words, the test for the chemicals.
The taste won't tell you anything.
So here's an email from Lisa in Bow, who says, as one of your guests said, I understand mistrust of municipal water supplies after Flint. Lisa says, however, my good sense tells me that drinking unfiltered water can make you very sick. That's why, Lisa says, people began filtering it. She says, there will always be folks who try to make money from others' fears, and this seems like nothing more than another profitable scam. Lisa says, I understand the desire to ingest natural water and food, but not everything natural is good for you. Remember that belladonna is naturally occurring. Good discussion, Lisa says. By the way, what is belladonna? Joe, Paul?
Belladonna is, it's an extract. It's a naturally occurring chemical in certain plants, such as the nightshade family, I think.
Okay. Well, and Taylor, you talked to some people in Maine who are also bottling raw water. I mean, there's two things going on here. One is people, again, like Joe's family, when he was growing up, going to this side of the road and grabbing some spring water. But then there are people who are making money from this. Who's making money from it locally, Taylor, New England?
So one of the companies that's specifically mentioned in the New York Times article that sort of kicked off a bit of the sort of uproar about this trend was a company called Tourmaline Springs. And it's run by a couple of guys in Maine, Seth Brzezanski and Brian Pullen. And they've got this sort of hilltop source that they claim is, you know, thousands of years old. Maybe the water is coming from the White Mountains, from a deep aquifer, all sorts of interesting stuff. They're selling it for, I think I bought a bottle for $4 for a pint.
Wow, that's a lot.
At the co-op, yeah.
Well, let's hear a clip from the Outside In episode on raw water. We're going to hear host Sam Evans-Brown interviewing the two people who run this company, Brian Pullen and Seth Brzezanski, co-owners of the raw water company called Tourmaline Springs, as you mentioned. And here they're responding to a question you guys asked them about the safety of their product. And this clip will start with Brian.
So we test for the presence of coliform when we bottle each time, and then quarterly we test for coliform again, and we also do swab tests of containers, bottles, and caps. And then annually we do the full battery for 200 chemicals, and they're doing everything there, you know, at upwards of parts per quadrillion.
We've never advocated drinking from a stream or even a spring that isn't checked, because it's a stupid thing in this day and age.
Even a roadside spring, you see a pipe there, but you have no idea what's going on between there and the source.
I think when we look at the backlash from like ER docs and like that kind of thing, like the CDC types, their concern is that people are going to hear this raw water, like untreated water, and think, oh, that's better. They're afraid that people are going to like start drinking out of streams again and like, you know, get poisoning from, you know, get Giardia and that kind of thing.
Yes, I agree with you. You're right. Yes, I agree with you, of course. But you could qualify what you say instead of just screaming at the top of your lungs about how dangerous this is. That nobody ever discusses how many people get sick from tap water every year.
Again, that's a clip from the recent Outside In episode on raw water called Magical Drinking. And producer Taylor Quimby is with us. And producer, so, you know, sounding a little defensive there. And you know, we have talked this whole hour about there have been problems with tap water as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when there was this really big backlash to this trend, and Brian and Seth said that they actually got death threats after that New York Times article. And I think they make a very important distinction, which is that treatment and testing are two different things. And, you know, if they're testing very regularly, then I think they can confidently say that their water is safe in the same way that other water that's tested regularly, as long as you know what's in it, then it could very well be safe. The fear that came out of that backlash is this idea that it's being untreated and that it's a total unknown. So that's maybe not the case for them. I can't speak for other companies that are sort of part of this live water, the raw water trend. However, I will say that in their marketing, I think they do play a little bit on those fears in order to be able to sell their product as well. And, you know, often I think they're maybe leaving out some details about the sort of natural contaminants that occur and playing on people's fears about the chemical names that we don't always have a good grasp of.
So it doesn't have bacterial contamination. There are naturally occurring contaminants that sounds, you know, oh, comes from the rock, sounds great, but... You know, radon and arsenic are serious problems.
And more to the point, I think, in their case, is that they play both sides of it, which is that their water is incredibly special, unique, ancient, geological. You know, these are all some of the phrases that they use in their marketing, where they make it seem like it is a one in a million source of water that's more pure than anything else you'll find. But then when the attacks came, they're quick to sort of say, listen, lots of people drink raw water. Lots of people drink untreated water in their wells. It's nothing special. So I think... when you're trying to sell a flavorless, a colorless liquid, and you're trying to, you know, deviate your brand and show why it is special, that's a difficult thing, and they maybe want to have it both ways. It's special, and it's nothing special.
Well, it's interesting, too, and this gets to, again, some of the language around this. You know, we talked earlier about deep, natural, ancient. Remind me, Joe, you said a couple minutes ago, ancient can mean that the water has had more time to hang out and get contaminated.
It sure can. And in places around the world, we do see that, and certainly in the U.S. as well. And even in New Hampshire, water can be quite old. But by and large, most of it is
newer here, you told us.
Comparatively,
because we're a wetter state.
And that said, I mean, not unlike Tourmaline Springs, a lot of people have wells that provide water that are also of very good quality. And so, you know, nothing against anybody providing water as a service or a business, but wells can also contain, by and large, very good water. It's those instances when they don't that we want to know about. So unfortunately, that means we have to test. Fortunately, it's relatively inexpensive to test when you consider it's the health of your person or your family that you're trying to protect.
Well, we heard earlier from that emailer in Goffstown who was definitely concerned about her well and was going to go out and get it tested. Here's a great email that I really want to get to before we close out, gentlemen. This is from Katrina. Does the state test roadside springs at all? Katrina says, the house I rent in Westmoreland has a water softener system that I just don't like. So I get my drinking water from the spring out on Route 12. After being here for 10 months, I developed a kidney stone. Never had any issues before, and I'm wondering if it's high magnesium in the spring water. Katrina says, is there any information from the state? Who takes care of these? For instance, who installs the iron pipe and the catch bowl? Are the springs ever tested? And Taylor, you found out in your story that there are 27 of these natural springs around the state?
There's 27 in New Hampshire,
springs.
According to findaspring.com.
Yeah.
There's actually probably way more than that on private property.
Just people don't list on the website.
Yeah, yeah. But most of those listed on the website are those roadside pipe sort of deal. And she raises a lot of good questions, and you two might know
the
answers.
Yeah, Paul, go ahead. So does the state test any of these popular springs like the one in Exeter that Joe told us about where lots and lots of people go?
We don't. They're not regulated at all. I think there might be a few instances where the local health officer does some testing. I've just heard anecdotally that there are some out there, but the state doesn't test them, and we don't have any ability to require testing of them. If there is some testing done, the local health officer does have authority to shut down those springs or to order that they not be used.
I see. So if large numbers of people in a certain community who got their spring water from a certain spring became ill, the local health authority could go test it and shut it down.
Right, or they could just go and test it, and then on the basis of the test results could shut it down.
Is magnesium in spring water, Joe? You may not know this, and that's okay. Could that cause somebody to get a kidney stone?
Well, indeed, you are out of my field of expertise.
Sure, that's okay. You're not a doctor, you're a geologist.
It does occur in waters, though. It's one of the more abundant cations that we do see in water results.
So to answer Katrina's question, it sounds like nobody's testing or looking at these, or nobody knows who installs the iron pipe and so forth. Okay, right. Katrina, thank you. And sorry to hear about your health issue there, by the way. That's tough. Here's one from John who says, I remember a spring on a backcountry road in Hillsboro many years ago. A black pipe coming down a steep hill fed a large wooden barrel by the side of the road. Hanging from the side of the barrel was a ladle. Passersby could simply stop and take a drink. Freshest water I ever tasted. John, thank you for the email. And Taylor, that's part of the pleasure of this that people are finding. And you know, let's be fair. Not all this water is going to, you know, make you sick.
No. I mean, I think there's a certain charm.
You drank plenty of it.
I did drink plenty of it. I'm okay now. I think there's a certain charm. There is also clearly a certain risk. So there is some decision making that has to be done. I think that everybody will tell you should test so that you know. And maybe then you're able to better evaluate the level of risk that you're taking. But yeah, a lot of these spots are very charming. I did the spring water tour. I had a nice afternoon.
All right. Well, Taylor, thank you for helping us out today and with this whole program and the preparation and so forth.
Oh, of course.
That's Taylor Quimby, again, senior producer for NHPR's Creative Production Unit, which includes Outside In. You can find the episode about magical drinking and subscribe to the podcast at outsideinradio.org. And Paul Suska, good to see you. Thank you for being here as well.
Happy to.
Paul Suska is supervisor for the planning unit at New Hampshire DES's Drinking Water and Groundwater Bureau. And Joe Ayotte, good to see you too. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Joe Ayotte is chief of the groundwater quality section for the New England Water Science Center and a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.